And welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. We're here with Mara Weaver, who just called me a gigantic ass for some reason. I'm not even sure. So listen, man, it's a thrill to have. I think this is going to be a fun one. Of course, this feature editor, John Gentile. We're here with Mara, who I've asked to be on the podcast numerous times, but it's always been like, oh, I'm on a world tour, John. Or, oh, John, I'm in the tour bus right now, you know.
Sorry, John. I'm learning how to do a backflip.
Actually, we're already off on a tangent, but let's do it. Mara, first, I watched this video with HR, and HR was saying, how come you don't do like backflips and stuff anymore? And he says, he named some guy who I have no idea who this guy is. He's like, so and so came up to me and he says, you're making it more about backflips than it is about the music. So you should just stand still and sing. And HR's like, and that really meant something to me. And I'm like, HR, that guy gave you the worst advice in all of music that you should stop being so awesome on stage. Anyways, of course, we're also here with M. Moore. M, what's going on? What's happening? M, this is our second interview that M and I have done today. We interviewed the Pogues earlier on.
Oh, really?
Today. Yeah.
The Pogues?
The Pogues. Legendary Pogues. Almost as important to music as Moira Weaver, of course.
And both Irish connection.
Did you guys actually interview the Pogues earlier? That's crazy.
We interviewed the Pogues.
James.
Wow, that's sick. James you were dead.
We didn't interview Shane. He's dead. But we interviewed James. He's alive.
Shane is dead. Maybe you guys have some connection beyond the grave. I don't know.
Actually, more.
We should try a seance.
Let me ask you about Shane, and then we're going to play a song. And then we're going to come back. Let me ask Moira about Shane, and then I keep saying her name, Mara. Moira.
Yeah, it's Mara, John.
I keep saying Moira, but it's Mara. Mara. Mara.
No, Moira's kind of cooler sounding.
Mara. Shane McGowan.
Yes.
Wasted potential or the flicker of insanity is what drives greatness, and you have to take the other side of the scale as well. Where do you stand with artists like that?
The second one, for sure.
Well, there you have it.
But I do think that he could have, you know, if the thing is, he made great art, but he was also insane, and he probably could have, like, done, I don't fucking know. He needed it both, you know? He needed both of the things.
Did Shane McGowan, an amazing singer, an amazing lyricist, did he owe it to society to look after himself better so that he could grant humanity more of the wonderfulness that he granted them when he wasn't at his worst state of mind?
I don't think so.
Oh.
Yeah, because I don't think he owed us his art, to be honest.
Oh, do tell.
Well, just in my mind, I'm like, if he wants to make it, then he can. But if he doesn't want to, then he doesn't have to. Like, would we rather have, like, a phoned-in terrible Pogues record or one that's, like, you know, like, none? I don't know. Maybe some people would rather have the phoned-in one, too. But in my mind, I'm just like, if he didn't want to keep making stuff, then, you know, I don't know.
Well, speaking of artists with the flame of insanity, Mora's got a brand new record. And it is called, The Flames of Insanity. It's called Devotion, which is cool. But the lead single is Prince. And Mora was even influenced by Prince, according to a little spiel about that. So we're going to play Prince the song, Strange Devotion. And we're going to talk about Prince, and we're going to talk about Mora and a whole bunch of other stuff. New record out, Strange Devotion, September 19 on Field Records.
Yeah,
Sam Hain Records in the shop as well as Moira Records. And anyways, this is Prince, and we will be right back.
Yeah.
You by the mouth, and I am feeling more.
Tell me about the track Prince, and is the influence of Prince the artist overstated or understated as to the tune?
So hold on, I'm turning my do not disturb on my phone. I have ADHD and I just got really distracted as soon as I got a notification. It's off now, it's off. So the song, okay, Prince, it being influenced by Prince is minor for sure, but the song came about like John Hoffman, who is my main collaborator. He was in The Mimes with me. He records, he's an engineer at this studio called The Lodge in Northern Kentucky across the river from Cincinnati. That's amazing. It's like super haunted Masonic lodge, crazy shit. That place is awesome. But we had already done a few songs at that point in the studio. And we were just like, trying to, with this album, we've been trying to like, just like have more fun with it and like be more experimental in the studio. Less like, I don't know, like with the first record, I love it, but it was more like I knew what I wanted with each song vibe wise. And this time John and I just like recorded a shit ton of songs. Like we recorded almost 20 songs, even though there's 10 on the album. But Prince specifically, John was just like, do you have any like voice memos you haven't sent me that we could like work on that might be good? And I was like, I don't know. I wrote this one the other day, but I thought it was kind of dumb. Like the chorus, I was trying to sound like Janet Jackson or something. Like it doesn't at all sound like Janet Jackson, but like, you know, the, if you want, you got me. Don't listen to my singing right now. It's bad. But like in my mind, I was just like, that's like a like super poppy whatever, and I just played him the voice memo and he was like, no, we should do it like if the rhythm was like a Prince rhythm, like minimal drums, like just kick, very like rhythmic but minimal, like because I tend to do more like four on the floor type beats and more power pop type beats, and on this record, we wanted to mess around with different kinds of stuff. So we rhythmically, we were inspired by Prince with the bass line too, which John wrote. So yeah, this record was like a big collaboration between me and John. Like some of the songs I wrote on my own and brought to him, but a lot of them we fleshed out in the studio in just the two of us. So we did it on the day of the Super Bowl though, in one day.
You, I mean, was that just coincidence or did like the Super Bowl have like some significance to you or something?
It didn't have any significance to me. I just remember it because like all my friends were at a Super Bowl party and like, I do like the Bengals, but I'm not like a huge like football person or anything, but all my friends were at a Super Bowl party and I knew Usher was going to perform and I love Usher. I grew up with Usher. Confessions was one of my first CDs. And all my friends were there and it was like my best friend's birthday. And I was like really annoyed that we were in the studio for so long. So I kept trying to like rush So that could have influenced how the song turned out. Like, I was just like, I don't know. Like, we just did it kind of like super fast. Like, just we're kind of pulling inspiration from nowhere. But we paused to watch Usher perform. And then I ended up going to my friend's party afterwards. But I just think it's funny because we just like, we pretty much did the whole thing in one day. And then we ended up like redoing the drums and bass with like, two guys who played on a lot of the record. One is Kane Kitchen. One is Alex Dungan. They work in the lodge too. So they ended up playing over what we did, but everything else like we did in one day. So yeah.
When I love the Melvins, and Buzz Osborne writes all the Melvin songs, but then he has the guys come in and then he lets them kind of do what they want with the songs. And he's not very precious, you know. By contrast, mm-hmm. and Melvins are my favorite band ever. By contrast, Danzig, who's my favorite band ever, he says, you must play the riffs like this. You must play the drums like this. This mm-hmm. is your record. Where do you stand in that spectrum?
I mean, it depends for me. I think like the first record, I was a little bit more unsure about, like I knew how I wanted the vibes to be, but I like, didn't have that much confidence in my guitar playing on the first record. So I let other people play a lot of like solos, and there were some ideas like I didn't want to do, but I just rolled with them because other people wanted to do them, you know? Whereas this time around, I really was like sticking up for my ideas. And if I didn't like something or if it needed to be done differently, I would say so. And that made the process interesting. Cause like, it was a studio record. We did want to like do it live with a band, but that just didn't end up happening. Like at first we were just like, we're just going to flesh songs out in the control room. And then we'll like get a band together to do it live. But like, we liked the control room recordings so much. We were just like, why would we redo this entire thing? You know what I mean? Like it would just be like a waste of time when we could just like move on to the next thing. Like we could do a live record next record, or like, you know, just trying to like take the pressure off a little bit and have more fun with it. So it really depends on like who, cause a bunch of different people like played on the record, but I did play more instruments than before. Kind of like I played all the guitar on the new record, except for one of my friends, Sam Stansfield. He played acoustic slide guitar and he played slide on a couple songs, but like, and John did play a couple parts, but for the most part, like all the solos are me, all the guitar tracks are me. And I definitely, there were a few times when like John got annoyed with me cause I made him like redo a song. Cause I was just like, this isn't right. You know, like we just ended up, there were like a couple that we like did three different versions of, but until they felt right. But he was like locked in with me. Like we were on the same page for the most part, you know? So
I think your guitar playing is actually super cool in this record. And one of the things that I find interesting about it is you're able to, I'm going to be very music critic here, effortlessly weave pop guitar with rock and even punk guitar. And I really like how it kind of is in both those areas at once without seeming like it's going to try hard. But here's the question. Back in the day, you know, pop and rock or pop and punk were very divided. You could only be one or the other. That barrier has completely fallen. And I feel you are taking advantage of that. Are you unabashedly a fan of pop and punk and feel they are actually one and the same?
Yeah. I mean, to me, like, honestly, the way I think about music, it's different than some other people in that, like, I don't feel very indebted to specific genres, even though I'm from the punk world and I consider myself like a punk. It's like, I can't imagine just listening to the same kind of thing my whole life. So like, I've gone on so many different rabbit holes of different kinds of music. Cause I'm just like, I grew up with all kinds of music. Like my mom was really into classic rock. And my dad was really into like 80s new wave and like synth pop and like trip hop even and stuff. So, and like Kraftwerk and like, I just grew up with so many different kinds of music that like, I when I'm writing a song, I just am like, what's going to serve the song or be interesting, you know? Because like my guitar playing is really influenced, I think, by like the Replacements and like all the power pop stuff and stuff like that. But I think you can, I don't know, I just try not to like think so much in terms of genre when I'm writing a song, because otherwise I don't think I would. Like Prince, for example, I, you know, we were jamming on the song and then like the guitar hook that's like in the chorus and in the post chorus, in my mind I was like, I'm gonna make a Sheryl Crow kind of guitar part. That's like what I was thinking in my mind. Just the like, sorry, my singing is funny right now. But like, I don't know. I think I just like, I love pop music though, first of all. Like, and I'm talking about like the history of pop music through the ages. Like, I really like Brill Building pop and like Carole King and like, I don't know, like Roy Orbison and a bunch of shit like that. And I think that a lot of punk is like more influenced by pop music than people think it is, you know? Like, I feel like there's so much discourse about like what's punk or not, or what's pop or not. And even though those are like divided now, I still see people arguing about them all the time. Like, I always like I'm like, I see people, bless you, Em.
Thank you.
She turned her microphone off, but I saw you sneeze.
Thank you.
Yeah, but like, I don't know. I see people like arguing, like they're like, Turnstile's not hardcore. Like,
well, Turnstile is not hardcore. And it's not, I am not a Turnstile fan, but I
knew
would say
I'd get you fired up.
Turnstile is not hardcore, but that doesn't mean that they're bad because they're not hardcore. I just don't know why people are engaging in this collective lie and say that they're hardcore. They're not hardcore. Parliament Funkadelic is not hardcore, and Parliament Funkadelic is like the best thing ever. So Parliament Funkadelic is not hardcore in the same way that Turnstile is not hardcore. I just want to know, why does everyone say, yo, oh, I love this new wave of hardcore? It's not hardcore. That's all I have to say about that.
I don't even really have a specific opinion about it. I think to me the reason people still stand by that is because there are some hardcore songs on their newer records, even though they're not that many, but just more like classically hardcore. And then because they're from the hardcore world, it's like there's a specific culture around that. So like the way people dress and the way that like, but in my mind, like hardcore is like such a funny genre, like having grown up in that, because I kind of grew up in like the hardcore scene in Cincinnati. It's like people are really specific about what they think is hardcore, what is like selling out or like blah blah blah. And I'm just like, I mean, there's all kinds of shit I could say about it, but like, just in my mind, I'm like, why are we even talking about whether they're hardcore or not? Like, yeah, they do make pop music. They also make hardcore songs. It's like they blew up for reasons beyond our understanding. You know what I mean? And that's probably done both positive and negative things for like the hardcore scene. I don't know. I'm not that involved in it anymore. But, you know, I just like, I definitely like on my record, I just was like, I'm just going to do whatever the fuck I want. I don't really care what genre it is, you know, which like, what? Yeah.
Along those lines, the press release says, Prince is a perfect iteration of the record's most powerful theme, rebuilding and reclaiming the ability to take ownership of one's art and one's life. Did you feel that other people were controlling your art and or your life?
I wouldn't say that they were controlling it, but more so like, I think the story behind the record, if there is like a story, is just that like after all of the bands that I've been in and my experiences, both super positive and some negative experiences, it's like I kind of was just letting myself be like a passenger, and I enjoyed all of those experiences and I did contribute too. But after like Mixtapes ended, for example, and then I started playing in bands again, like there was a really long period where I didn't write songs, or I just didn't finish songs, more so because of like a lot of the shit I had been through. And honestly, like, I know now, like, looking back, it's like mixtapes is like pretty small, but when I was 18 and I first started playing in that band, the amount of attention we were getting and that I was getting was like really overwhelming, you know? So it kind of like, I don't think that was the reason why I wasn't writing songs, but just a lot of different stuff in my life and like mental health problems were why I wasn't writing songs. And I kind of had to like put my foot down in my own life and heart and be like, no, I want to work on my own thing, even though it feels hard to say no to people and all the other bands I'm in and like stick up for what I'm trying to do. It's just like, I've always wanted to do this at the end of the day. Like, and it doesn't mean I'm not going to play in other bands or I'm not going to like play with bands I've played with in the past at any point. It's just like, this record was, the first record felt like me just like feeling really like broken and kind of just like putting it out there. And this one feels more like a statement of like musically what I want to put across into the world, which is like, I just had more fun with this record, honestly. And there was more experimenting and like, I felt more confident in my songwriting and guitar playing. And like, you know, I guess that's kind of the, you know, the theme, if there's a theme.
You said on the first record you felt broken. Well, how are you feeling now? Are you feeling less broken? Are you feeling more broken? Where are you at right now?
Well, the world's bad right now.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate that I'm like laughing. It's just you have to laugh through the pain, you know? So that's bad. Like that feels broken. And that's really like things are so fucked up right now. It's really difficult not to feel that way. But in my personal life, I feel a lot more like secure in who I am and like confident. So I'd say I'm more put together now, you know, but they also started me on my Vyvanse again. So that helps.
I'm going to ask you a heavy question and then we're going to finish it up with some wacky questions and hit some news.
Sure.
In this press release, it says you had a stalker and I'm not trying to make it about me, but I had a female stalker once. And
no, I want to talk about this shit.
I thought that like might be kind of fun, and it wasn't fun at all. And the girl stalker to the guy is bad. But was your stalker a guy?
Yeah.
And that's like kind of like even more. You know what I mean? Because dudes can be a lot creepier. So like even when I had a female stalker, it like sucked ass, man. It sucked.
Yeah.
Ass.
So anybody can be a stalker. It's fucked up. I mean, have you seen Baby Reindeer?
No.
You would probably be, do you know what it's about?
No.
Okay, so it's a show on Netflix that came out like last year, and it's about a female stalker. And like, she's not the protagonist, like the male guy kind of is, but like, it really like, I've never seen anything that delves more into that topic than that. So much so that like, when I watched it, I don't like to like overuse therapy speak or anything like that, but like I was really triggered when I watched it. Like,
yeah.
It was good. It was good though. Like, I'm glad I watched it. It's not like wasn't a bad thing. It's just like I was watching it and then I was kind of like, why am I like completely dissociating and feel like really fucked up? And it's like, going through something like that just like sticks with you in a way that I think a lot of people don't realize, especially like for me, that person was like a guy that I dated when I was pretty young. Like I was 18 and it lasted like a year there. He stalked me for almost a year and like the authorities had to get involved and like he was threatening me with like suicide, like not to like get into the, you know, but like I, and like all this other stuff. And I thought that I like, that was around the time too that mixtapes was kind of taking off. And actually, funnily enough, that guy introduced me to Ryan, which is wild. But like when I got out of that situation, finally, I thought I was like over it, but it's just weird because like when things happen to you at that age, I think a lot of times you're just like, I'm fine, because you're just trying to move on and it's too like heavy or overwhelming. But like, later on in my adult life, I realized like how much that affected like so many of my relationships, you know, like with myself and with other people. Like I was always comparing whoever I dated like to him. Like I was like, well, they're not like him at least, you right, know, right. They're not like this or that. And like, it was just like a really like psychologically like fucked up thing that happened to me. And like I was saying, maybe it's like weird that this is coming up now, but like for some reason, you know, one of the songs on the record, which is going to be the second single, Museum Glass, it was like important for me to like talk about that being what it's about, because, you know, I think it's happened to a lot more people than we realize. And like at the time I really was like, I'm fine. And like, it didn't even cross my mind that I was like being abused, or I was like hesitant to call him like a stalker or admit that he like sexually assaulted me and all this stuff. And I just was like, I'm fine, you know, it's not that big of a deal. And then like as I got older, I was like, no, dude, no, fuck that shit. Like I needed to process that. And like sometimes it just like comes up and rears its head in a really like strange way. And like, yeah, for some reason when I was writing that song, I like started writing about something else, and then that just kind of happened, and it was all really specifically about that and like how that's affected me as a person now and like what it does to you, you know? So it's wild that you had a stalker too.
I know. For me, who would guess, you know?
You should watch that show.
All right, I'll watch. Honestly, it was a total bummer. Like at first I thought it would be kind of funny. Like I thought it was funny, but it got not funny real quick. And actually, you know Sam Barrett, editor Sam Barrett?
Yeah.
One time we were at a show and I had to pretend that she was my girlfriend because my stalker was like there like stalking me. So I'm like, Sam, you got to pretend that you're my girlfriend. You know what I mean? So it was weird, man.
That's so fucked up.
With a song like that, recording it, performing it, is it cathartic? Is it painful? Is it both? You know what I mean?
It honestly like felt really cathartic. I mean, I think that's why I felt really like I wanted it to be a single, is because like I just can't describe it, but it's like, when I wrote it and performed it live for the first time, because this is a song I've been playing live for a year and a half now, probably. Actually, maybe more than that. This was the first one I wrote for the album that I knew was going to be on the album. And I just like, it just felt really good because I feel like in the past, it's really hard to like try and write about something. Like there were definitely times I tried to write about specific things and like it just didn't feel genuine, you know? And this time it just, for whatever reason, it just like happened. And like I wrote it really fast and it just kind of came out, and like performing it live was like interesting because like my sister happened to be there the first time I played it and stuff, and immediately knew what it was about, you know? Even though I don't like explicitly say what it's about in the lyrics, it's like my sister knew exactly what it was about, which like it just felt like good because honestly, every time I've played it, I've had someone come up to me and ask me about it and tell me that they like related to it or something. And it like, that like means a lot to me, you know? Cause like, I don't know if it's going to be a good single. Like I honestly had some people discourage me from using it as a single just cause like there are poppier songs on the record and like more catchy songs and stuff. But I was just like, I don't know. I just kind of want it to have its moment, you know, like I could have talked about it later on after the record came out, but like, I don't know. For whatever reason, I was just like, I just kind of want to put this one out there, you know? So
well, not only do I back that decision from an artistic standpoint, I back it from a business standpoint too, because a lot of artists will hit you with the poppier tracks and then you get the album and the other ones are very sad, such as Modern English. But when you hit them with the sad tracks and then they get the poppier ones, a la Prime, Tegan and Sarah, that's where it's at.
Yes. I love Tegan and Sarah. They're definitely like an influence for me. I've loved them since I was like 14.
How come Tegan and Sarah are always so sad though? Like in every interview, they're always
sad. I know they are. You know what's funny too is that, so I've only seen them live once. I saw them in 2009 and you know, showing my age to listeners, but I'm sure the listeners are probably, we're probably all similar age for the most part. But like, they were the funniest band I've ever seen. Like live, they're hilarious.
Right, right.
They're doing bits the whole time. And so it's funny because their songs are like so unbelievably sad, you know, but also poppy. And I think I just like, I don't know. I related to that when I was like a kid with depression and shit like that. I was like, they're writing like super poppy songs, but then it's just like the saddest lyrics ever. But that's like such a classic pop thing to do, you know, like Tears of a Clown.
Not Marvin Gaye. Who's Tears of a Clown?
Tears of a Clown is no, it's Smokey Robinson.
Smokey Robinson, classic, classic. Maura,
love it.
You recorded this album in a haunted studio, I heard. How many ghosts did
that
you see?
That is true. I think I saw two ghosts.
Whoa, what was the deal with them? Were they scary? Were they cool? What was the deal?
No, they weren't scary. They just were. So here's some little haunted backstory about the studio. So the place where the studio is in a really old Masonic lodge. And, you know, the guy who owns it, Scott, is amazing. Shout out Scott Bessler. But it's like this really weird, like, artist studio combination show space / synth repair shop in the basement / you know, recording studio. And it's both Scott and John Hoffman collect clowns. So it's absolutely full of scary clown art also. So that adds to the atmosphere, but like this building. So the Freemasons are an odd bunch, as I'm sure you guys know. And there's a closet in the lodge that John, a lot of times Mike's amps in, that they used to use to haze Freemasons. So they would put them down a trap door into this closet, and then they would put a human skeleton in there with them, and they would have to like claw their way out. They would you would keep them in there for like hours. I'm dead serious. I don't remember how Scott knows this, but like he's done a lot of research into the history of the building, and like you can see handprints still in that closet all over the place. And like weird scratch marks, and like John and Scott and many people who have been in and out of that building have seen ghosts or had weird things happen. And I don't know. So like I've had a lot of paranormal stuff happen to me in my life, but I've never really seen what I thought was a ghost until recently. But when I was at the lodge during the recording of this album, at one point, I swear to God, I would like look down towards the stairwell and I saw two guys who were like, one was like wearing a red polo shirt and was like an older guy in his like 60s with white hair. And like another guy next to him who was just wearing like a button down and was also like an older white guy. And I literally like thought I saw them, and then I looked back and they weren't there. And I was like, John, I feel like I just saw like a couple Freemasons. Like, I don't know if it was my imagination though. Like, I just feel like in my mind they were so visually specific. And he was like, you saw your first ghost at the lodge. He was like, I've seen shit like that a lot before. And I was like, that's crazy, dude. But like, it doesn't feel like bad energy in there, even though the fucking like whatever torture closet is not good, obviously. You know, it's like, I used to be really scared of like paranormal stuff when I was a kid, like horrified. And it would happen to me or someone in my family. Everyone in my family has had like weird paranormal experiences in the same houses as each other. And we didn't realize it until we were older. And like, I was so scared of it. And now that I've gotten older, I've still had experiences, but I've just kind of been like, hey, if there's somebody there, like, I'm here too, and we can coexist. Like, if you're chill, I'm chill. Like, I'll literally, like, say that. And it's, like, it's been fine. I mean, I don't know. Like, I feel like I haven't really had, like, a negative one recently. except for I did buy a mirror that I believed was haunted, and I ended up selling it on Facebook Marketplace for $250, and I listed it as a haunted object, and it kind of went viral on Facebook.
Well,
I was being serious.
Speaking of mirrors, just a couple last questions, then we'll play another track and we'll come back and hit the news. The video for Prince has got a somewhat haunted mirror in it with you looking at a distorted, bloody reflection of yourself. What's the metaphor there? Or if you want to keep it secret, you don't have to say.
Oh, it's not secret. It's just Twin Peaks. It is. We were just like, the thing is, the lyrics to Prince, and this is another example of me kind of just like taking the music making a little less seriously, is like, this was one of the first times I wrote about like a fictional character. So I'm like in love with Agent Cooper from Twin Peaks and Kyle MacLachlan in general. I just think he's amazing. And like, I've always just been obsessed with him. And so the song was about my love for Dale Cooper and Twin Peaks. So in the music video, you know, we were just like, we don't want to just like rip off Twin Peaks, but we just want to like bring across that vibe. Otherwise people aren't going to know what it's about, you know? So there's like the scene where Agent Cooper is like possessed by Bob. I don't know if you guys have seen Twin Peaks really, but he like looks in the mirror and he sees like Bob, and he's all scary and like fucked up and bloody and stuff. So that's what we were trying to do. But yeah, even the lyrics in the song, like, are little Twin Peaks, like, Easter eggs. Like, I say, like, I can't discern why the mill is burned. It gets tedious, but still I find a way to yearn. That's about season 2 of Twin Peaks, because it's really tedious and confusing. And, like, there's, like, this whole storyline about the mill burning down, and you're like, what the fuck's going on? You know what I mean? So, like, it's just Twin Peaks stuff, you know? I just love Twin Peaks.
Well, they have it, Maura, with the excellent Twin Peak reference in the very artistic Prince video and song. Last question, Maura. Let's get even trippier, and then we'll play a tune. You talked about ghosts and all that kind of stuff. Can one manifest reality? That is, can you say, I want, or this will happen, and XYZ does happen?
I think, to a degree, yes. I think that, because in my mind, we have more control of our reality than we think. Like, I think a lot of us are very like, we feel like we're pulled in different directions. We don't have control. But in my mind, I'm like, one of the only things that we have control of is like how we respond to things and what we put out into the world. So in that way, I do think we can manifest reality, because, you know, I've seen it in my own life in strange ways. Like, for example, when like, you know, the Homeless Gospel Choir, which I was in that band for a while, we toured with My Chemical Romance. It was so weird because, you know, that felt so out of the blue to me. But the same week that, you know, that got announced or we got that confirmed or whatever, I found an old journal of mine from when I was 12. And the first page that I opened up to was me talking about how much I loved My Chemical Romance, one. Whoa. And was also about how all I wanted in my whole life was to be in a band and make music. And that's all I cared about. And it was talking about how I was maybe going to go to Florida to see My Chemical Romance. And I was so excited. That didn't end up happening. But flash forward to, you know, almost 20 years later, I played Florida with My Chemical Romance, which is like, you know, some would say
trippy.
I've had people be like, ask me how I've gotten specific opportunities. And I do think that like some people, you know, have more luck than others. Obviously bad things and good things happen to people randomly, but like, I feel like every opportunity that I've had, I've tried to like soak it in and make the most of it and try to move forward from there. And I feel like that's, looking at life with that open-ended mindset can bring you a lot more places than you think, you know? Cause I don't know. I just think that like, yeah, I'm not in like a woo-woo way with like manifesting like some people are, but I think that like I really do believe in karma. Like, I believe what we put out into the world and how we treat people in our everyday life is the most important thing. And I think that that gives back to you in many ways, because if you want to help other people, a lot of times they want to help you, or they remember that, you know, and then they help you later on. And like, and it's just like a, not like a, you owe me something, but more of just like, if you have that mindset, I just think it can take you a lot of places. So yeah, I guess long story short, I do think manifesting reality is very, you know, real, but I'm also mentally ill. So, you know, that reality is manifested in many ways for me too.
Well, there you have it. If you have that mindset, it can take you many places, as per Moira. And as Moira has a devotion to things, her new record, Strange Devotion, it's out September 19th via Feel It Records. I'm going to definitely get it. I'm super psyched on it. Hopefully more tours. That'll be a cool tour. Are you going to go on tour for the record? Or?
Yeah. Not all of it's been announced yet, but I am doing a tour in late October, early November with this band Future Teens from Boston, who are awesome. In this band, ADJY, and we're playing the East Coast. We're playing Philly. We're playing Brooklyn, and hell yeah!
So anyway,
I'll see you there.
Let's play a new Moira. We could talk to Moira about this stuff for hours. So we'll definitely have to have more. We're not kicking her off. We're at the news, but we'll definitely have to talk to Moira about more of her record, more of the supernatural stuff, more of her history with so many different bands. I forgot about Homeless Gospel Choir on a split with the icon Joe Jack Cockham. Of course, we didn't even touch on the Mind, but we're gonna play Mind track later. But let's play more track.
Love Moira, Joe Jack.
Joe's the man. Moira, what track should we play?
Ooh, I'd say Jefferson Highway.
Jefferson Highway is off her first solo record, and this is Jefferson Highway, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Thanks.
And we are back, and we're going to hit some news. We're going to give Maura a little bit of a break, and I'm going to hit some news, and M's going to talk about it and then respond, and Maura's going to respond, and we'll get through as much as we can. So, of course, there was a big shakeup in the drumming world over the past month or so. Foo Fighters fired Josh Freese, and he went on Instagram. He said, I have no idea why I got fired. And not only did I get fired, I got fired by the manager, not the band themselves. Everyone's like, well, who's the new Foo Fighter drummer going to be? And a lot of people were thinking it was going to be Taylor Hawkins' son. And Taylor Hawkins' son said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Anyways, Josh Freese has got a new gig. He's back with Nine Inch Nails, who he was with through 2008. And now the Foo Fighters drummer is, Eland Rubin, who was in the Nine Inch Nails. So they kind of swapped drummers, which is kind of weird. M, why do you think Josh Freese got fired from the Foo Fighters? And A, why do you think he got fired from the Foo Fighters? B, was it smart of him to admit that he got fired? Or should he have played it off as like, oh, no, we went separate ways? C, do you like that he's now back in the Nine Inch Nails? D, is it weird that they swap drummers? E, will Dave Grohl ever be able to regain his nice guy of rock and roll title? Or is that forever blemished?
Okay, so I think it's really funny. Yeah. Yeah. A, B, C. So I think it's really funny that they just like swap drummers. And that was it. Like, it's
so funny.
You know, it's all the speculation about like, oh, who's gonna take the gig and all this, and I was just like, nope, that's it. No big deal. Just like it was a plan all along and it just hadn't been announced yet or something. So I thought that was really funny. I really like Josh Freese's statement where he's like, Nine Inch Nails was a band that left me walking off stage every single night thinking that was incredible. We absolutely crushed it. And it wasn't just a feeling, it was a certainty. The level of intensity, pride, and satisfaction after each show is something I've rarely experienced anywhere else. Take that, Foo Fighters.
Yeah. Take that, you know. Dave.
Take that, Dave. Go to hell.
Dude, I I'm not even a huge like Nine Inch Nails person, but like reading that made me want to go see them like now with Josh Freese. Yeah. Like I was like, I'm going to go see him now. Like I'm going to pay fucking for a ticket so I can see him shred with fucking Nine Inch Nails. Like, but it's really weird that they just took Nine Inch Nails drum. Like, how did that even happen? Like, I don't even know. It almost feels like it's just like it was a stunt or something.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it did get them all a lot of like, you know, press and stuff. I mean, I don't really like.
True.
I'm sure it wasn't a stunt, but like, it's just so funny that they swapped to me. Like maybe like Foo Fighters offered the Nine Inch Nails drummer more money or something. And then like Josh Freese was like, I'm gonna take that spot because I love playing with them. Who knows? But it's pretty fucking funny.
I would think drumming with Nine Inch Nails would be easier because you're drumming to a drum machine because you have to because of the songs.
True.
You know?
True.
So, I mean, he could probably not do hardly anything back there. But Josh Freese being Josh Freese, I think he wants to drum and he wants people to see him drumming. So,
yeah. He's born to drum.
So the question is, Dave Grohl, yes. Is the nice guy image forever tarnished? I say it is. And I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry because I know people that know Dave. Well, like I said before, I know one person that knows Dave, and he says he's cool. And I know two other people that know Dave, and they say he's not cool. So there you go. Anyways.
Ooh.
So anyways, Military Gun, they got a new track out. It's called Bad Idea. And Military Gun, where do you stand? And is this bad idea a good idea or a bad idea?
I like some Military Gun stuff, but I haven't really been like blown away by any of their albums. I really like this song, though. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the when they're spelling it out and it's just like very
it's like cheerleader-esque or something.
Yeah, it's really like,
or even like Ramones core.
Yeah, but like it has that like heaviness like to it, and it's just, it's so good. It's very repulsive. I guess.
Dude, I felt the same way.
But
I've
yeah.
never really like listened to them much, but
Yeah.
I really like this song. I like the like halfway through when it goes into like the B part, it kind of reminded me of like Jade Tree or something. Like
Ooh.
it reminded me of like that era of punk, like specifically like I was for some reason I was thinking because I hadn't listened to it in so long, I was like it's giving like some oi in a way, like certain parts, like almost like Coxbar influence or like Stiff Little Fingers, but
Oh,
then
cool.
also like Good Riddance Kill Your Idols split. That's so random, but like it's just the guitar playing and the bass tone, like halfway through that part, it was giving me that, you know. But I just liked it. I was like, I'm all about bands doing this kind of thing, this sound right now.
Well, here's a bummer story that I'm going to kick into, and if Em and Maura want to talk about that, can if they don't want to, that's fine too. So, of course, the listeners certainly know that Justin Sane was sued by Christina Sahardi for sexual assault, and of course, about 10 or even more other women also accused Justin Sane of anti-flag of sexual assault. And then he kind of disappeared, and Christina Sahardi said, "We think he's fleeing to Ireland," and we'll talk about exactly why he chose Ireland in a second. And then she also sued the again not the against him, I'm sorry, not the anti-flag. Was it an LLC or a corporation? Do you remember? I think it was a corporation, right?
I
Or
think
was
it
an
was
LLC?
LLC.
Okay, she also
Yes, I
sued
think
the
so.
I think you're right. She sued the anti-flag LLC, and a court ruled that the anti-flag LLC is not responsible for the acts of one of its members, which would be Justin Sane, which, while perhaps sad in this case from a legal standpoint, I agree with. But I also agree with that she should definitely pursue Justin Sane himself for damages. So anyway, she got a default judgment against Justin for $1.9 million, which includes $750,000 in punitive damages and almost $1.2 million in actual damages. And of course, a default judgment is when you sue someone and they don't respond to the complaint, so you win automatically without any evidence ever being brought up because they didn't respond to the complaint. And so while on the face of this might look like, quote, good news, it's actually terrible news. Usually, when a party lets a default judgment gets filed against them, it means they're either judgment proof, which means they have no money, B, they are unreachable, meaning they're in another country or their assets are hidden, or C, they're planning on filing for bankruptcy. In this case, you probably couldn't discharge it through bankruptcy because you usually cannot discharge intentional civil torts in a bankruptcy, as opposed to a breach of contract or negligence. And so what that means, he's probably either judgment proof or he's unreachable. He's probably not judgment proof because we know anti-flag has lots of money, which means he's probably unreachable, which means he probably is in Ireland. So what that means is, so she's got a $2 million judgment against a guy in Ireland, and unless he's got bank accounts in the United States, or unless he's got real property in the United States, which he might, and I'm giving away free legal advice here, the first thing that she would want to do is attach those bank accounts and attach that real estate. But it appears that he's a pretty sneaky guy, and so he might have already transferred those assets. Or is Justin saying married? If he's married, I don't know if he's married or not. If he's
I don't
married,
know.
the real property could also
Yeah.
be in his wife's name, which makes it much harder to attach, if impossible. So the point being, he's in Ireland. You can enforce a judgment against a foreign country. I mean, not against a foreign, against a person in a foreign country. If their assets are in America, you can go if the assets in America. His assets probably not in America. His assets probably are in Ireland. You can transfer a judgment from USA to Ireland, but the answer to that is good luck, for multiple reasons. First of all, Ireland is in the EU; they're not in the UK. America's attachment is closer to the UK than it is the EU as a whole. Second, it's Ireland, of all the European, of all the Western European countries, is one of the hardest countries to exact a foreign judgment in because they're Ireland, and Ireland's big thing is, you can't take us over. We're Braveheart. You know, we've been taking, you know, there's been imperial conquest from England forever. There's been imperial conquest from Rome. There's been imperial conquest from the Anglo-Saxons, and we fought them back every time. And so we don't want anybody coming into our land. And so that certainly has trickled down to the legal system, in that it's hard to enforce a foreign judgment in Ireland because it's not that the Irish people or the Irish government is looking out for Justin Sane, but they're like, who is this American person coming to exert their laws in my country, you see? So while you can exert a judgment in Ireland, it's very hard to get through the red tape. I mean, even if you do, there's the practicalities of it. Like, The only way you actually enforce a judgment in America, you have a sheriff or a federal agent do it. So whatever the equivalent is in Ireland, the local sheriff, he's not going to walk down to the Irish bank and say, okay, we've got to levy this bank account. He's going to throw it under some bin. And then you got to call up 6 months to enforce that judgment. It's like, oh, we're getting to it. 6 months later, oh, we're going to get to it. So there's many, 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 many hurdles. Anyone, not just this case, anyone that is trying to exactly foreign judgment in Ireland, that is basically impossible. Unless you got like a judgment against like IBM in Ireland or something, you're probably not going to get it. So quite sadly, Christina, who I certainly believe, and I doubly believe, because if Justin didn't do what she accused him of, the first thing he should do is say, I didn't do it, and you know, he should prove. The fact that he ran away and didn't do anything, to me, that's dead in the water. You know what I mean?
It's insane that he just ran away.
Yeah, well,
he didn't even respond.
I mean, I don't. If anybody accused me of doing something I didn't do, the first thing I would say, I didn't do it. I'm suing you because I didn't do it. You know, the fact that he ran away, I mean, that says all you need to know. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, so, he's like, that's like international criminal stat. Like he's like, oh my, like it's just. I mean, everybody's already said this, but it's just ironic that like a band like Anti-Flag, and I'm not blaming the other members by any means, but like that their front person is responsible for something like this and is just running away. When in the past they were just like, he was so like, you know, we're like pro-feminist and anti-establishment and like stick up for what's right. And then it's just like, I'm an internationally wanted criminal, basically. Yeah. Or maybe not like wanted, but like, I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine. I just, somebody said in the comments of this, just in debt, which I thought was pretty funny.
Well, he is in debt. What I will say is and I've done this rap a whole bunch of times. Anytime any artist or anybody or any politician gets up on a pedestal and says, I'm perfect, I'm right, I am
moral. Oh, yeah, they're
and these
always
people are bad. It's always hiding. Suspect. Always suspect.
They're
you know?
Always hiding. It's always those people who are hiding something, I feel like.
So I feel bad for Christina. She's going to have a hard time getting her judgment. I hope she gets it. But
well, that's what I was wondering, like, because you know stuff about legal things, apparently. I am an idiot with these things. And I'm like, so because she won, but she can't get the assets if he doesn't have them? Is that correct?
Like, if you sue someone for $1 million and they only have $10, the most you can get is $10.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know if there was some sort of, like, just because I don't know. Like, I didn't know if there's some sort of, like, way that person can get that money to you or if they're just going to be under debt to you forever or, like, what...
Yeah, well, excellent question. Here's the answer. So the fact of the matter is Justin probably does have – he must have significant assets. Annie Flagg was an internationally touring – let's say he's got $1 million.
In the 90s. In the 90s when CDs 90s. Were selling. That's and that they 90 own their own, CD money.
And they own their own record label and put out their own records, which is pure cash, you know.
Yep.
So let's say he doesn't have $2 million, but let's say he's got $1 million, right? So she has to get to the million. So if the million is in a bank in the USA and she knows where it is, she can get the money out of the bank. She can take it, right? But if she, doesn't know where the money is, then hypothetically he has to tell her. But if she gets a court order ordering him to tell her where the money is and he doesn't do it, what can a USA court do to some guy living in Ireland? The answer is nothing, you see.
Oh, okay. I get it. I get it.
And so let's say he's got $1 million in Ireland. Hypothetically, she can transfer the judgment to Ireland and then enforce it through the Irish court systems, but good luck being a foreign entity trying to enforce a judgment in Ireland. You know what I mean?
Okay. Now, this is making more sense to me. Before you were talking, and I was like, kind of know what you're saying, but not really, but now this makes sense.
Now, let's say he's got no money. Then she's not going to get anything. And now, hypothetically, let's say he wins the lottery 5 years from now. She can get the money then, but the fact of the matter is he's hiding it. I mean, he's being a real bastard. He's hiding his money. He's probably in Ireland with his cash. Or maybe his money's not even in Ireland. Maybe it's in Switzerland. Maybe it's in China. Maybe it's in Hong Kong. Could be anywhere. You know what I mean? Good luck getting it there, you know? So, you know, so I feel bad for it, but she's probably not going to get her money.
Yeah, me too.
And it only underscores kind of what a bastard this dude is, you know? So, listen, man, question your – like Jello says, question everything. But here's a fun story. Cox Bar, They've announced their final LA show, which literally sold out in like 20 minutes. They actually announced a second show. First of all, Cox Bar keeps announcing, like they said, this is our final punk rock bowling show. Which
what?
And like the last punk rock bowling, like Cox Bar, this is our final punk rock bowling show. And I'm like, oh, does that mean they're not playing America anymore? And the answer was, no, they're just not playing punk rock bowling. Which if I was a punk rock bowling organizer, I'd be like, that's what?
Yeah.
But now they're not playing. Now that they announced their final California show. So, I mean, they're getting, I mean, Cox Bar is actually older than punk. Cox Bar was a band.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah, 1972. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
That's actually crazy. I did not know they were that. I mean, I knew they were old, but like, that's crazy, honestly.
So
probably in their 70s.
They're like 75, 76, almost as old as Charlie Harper, who's 80, the legend Charlie
Damn,
Harper.
Dude.
So I think what Cox Bar is doing is I think they're kind of milking their final USA shows, which I don't blame them. I mean, why not? You know, and let people enjoy it. So anyway, Cox Bar, the shows are, who would imagine a Cox Bar show would sell out in 20 minutes? Maura, are you a Cox Bar fan? Are you sad that we're approaching the end of Cox Bar? Or are you happy?
Oh,
maybe you hate Cox Bar.
No, I love them. I love Cox Bar. We're coming back. We're coming back to you. Is that what it says?
Coming back to you.
We're never gonna go away again. Even though they are. Hold on a little longer.
Or we'll never walk alone. But you will after this tour. After this tour, you will walk alone. You know?
There you go. No, actually saw them once in Chicago when I lived there briefly at, I think it was Concord Music Hall. And it was awesome but terrifying because Chicago is full of giant skinheads, so it was just like me. That's when I think I might have had a Chelsea cut anymore, but like I briefly I went through a period where I was like, and I'm still really into like original ska and like rock city and stuff, but I was like going through a you know, an oi, kind of like skinhead, obviously, anti-racist skinhead, kind of like thing where I was like, I'm not a skinhead at all, but I like really like this culture and music. And I'm just, you know, it's funny now to say, cause I'm like, I'm clearly not, cause I'm not still living that way, you know, I don't know, but I love that shit though. I love Cox Bar. One reason I love them is because they write pop songs. Their songs are so catchy and good, but they have that fucking, you know, they pump you up. And I don't know, they're just a great band. And they're playing with Dillinger 4 in Homefront. And I would love to see that show because Dillinger 4 is one of my like all-time favorite bands. And Dillinger 4 and Cox Bar, that's going to be crazy. It's going to be crazy. So I didn't know that was happening until you told me about these stories. And I was like, fuck, I would have liked to go to that, you know? So.
Well, Maura, I'm going to put you on the spot. Can someone be American and be skinhead? Or is that just cosplay? I say you can't really be a skinhead and be American. I say it's cosplay.
I kind of agree with you. And that's the thing. That's why I never like called myself. I was like, I'm not a skinhead. Like I just like, the thing is that culture like has such good fashion. And I think I really liked that, to be completely honest. Like I was like, oh, it's like punks who care about how they look and are like wearing like cool ass looking jackets. And like, you know, they're not just like, oh, like, I don't care how I look. I'm gonna like smell like a skunk or something. You know what I mean? It's like, I just like, and I like the history of the whole movement, but I was never like, I'm a skinhead, you know, because that was, I kind of agree with you in that I think it's a bit of a cosplay. Like when I see bands or people who aren't British also trying to be British, it really rubs me the wrong way.
I agree, except for when Al Jorgensen sings with an English accent on the First Ministry record, which I love. And more, what culture has the worst fashion? Is it Insane Clown Posse, or does that go back around to being so bad it's good again?
I think that goes back to so bad it's good again.
Agreed. Agree with him.
I will say who has the worst fashion. Crust Punk.
Okay.
And I mean, I love Crust Punk. I love Amoebics, even though Rob Miller's kind of weird these days.
Yeah.
I love Anti-Sec. I love Nausea. The fashion itself looks cool, but they do smell terrible. And all the clothes are so
yeah.
worn out. And the fact of the matter is, you actually could take a shower if you wanted to. Even if you're broke, you can find places to take a shower. And that's performative. So it's really Crust Punk.
Yeah, that's what it, you know, what's funny is that when I was saying like skinheads have good fashion and I was like, you know, they care how they look. They don't smell like a skunk. The antithesis of that in my mind was the Crust Punk. That's what I was thinking, but I didn't say it. But like half the time, Crust Punks are like rich kids anyway. And
I mean,
I'm not saying like, I'm not judging, but it's just funny. I'm like, bro, you don't have to smell that bad. Why you got to do that? Like, I like the fashion too, to a degree. Like I've got a ripped up crass shirt that was sewed back together with, you know, dental floss. But like, you know, most of the time when you see somebody like that, you know, they're going to stink. So that's why I think the fashion is kind of bad.
Well, they have it. Speaking of someone that has kind of neutral fashion, Micah fucked up. He's got a new solo record coming out. I would say he's not high fashion. He's not low. He's just some guy in a shirt and pants. You know what I mean?
Some guy.
His new record is called Boy Commandos. It's kind of power popish, and really, it's him and Jonah fucked up working together. Em, are you excited about this, or do you have trepidation? Because like Mike, why are we working on these solo records when we could be working on more fucked up? How do you feel about the Mike Halichuk solo record, Em?
I don't know if I think it's a distraction from the fucked up thing, but for them, but also kind of for us, because it's like, oh, they're definitely not working on something. And then like a week from now, they'll be like, here's a Zodiac, or, you know, here's like something, you know, because like, you know, they're doing like a million things all at once. That's kind of what I get from it. The song was all right. It didn't like really grab me. It was just okay. Like, I thought it was neat. And then we have the kind of the mime paint back too. So it's like, what does this mean?
I saw that. I was like,
do you feel ripped off, Maura?
Yeah, I'm so mad. You know, they ripped me off. There can only be one mime, you know, and it's me. I'm a real mime. I went to mime school. No, I wish that were true. That would make me much cooler. But I, you know, what's funny is that I've always like, really respected fucked up and I like them, but I've never delved. Like, I would love to know where to start, because I got really into their record that has like the other shoe on it. I'm trying to remember what it's called.
Oh, that's
it has like
light,
light bulbs
it?
On it.
David.
Yes,
David
that was
life.
The one that I got into, but I haven't really like I know they have like a huge kind of cult following and like a ton of people love them, and I've just never really known like where to start, I think, because they have so much stuff, you know? So I've always been kind of tapped out of that universe.
I will give M, yeah. I mean, not M, Maura, my three effed up recommendations, and then M will, and then she can choose from there. And then we will do the final story and wrap this on up. Maura, it's been great having you on. You've been a blast.
Yeah.
We've got one more story after this.
Hey, we'll thanks for having up. Me.
John's top three effed up recommendations. Number one, Police, the classic punk banger. Number two, Year of the Pig, one of the most experimental and far out records. Number three,
cool.
Year of the Dragon, their heavy metal record. And more.
Ooh,
what's your recommendation?
I like that. That's cool. My first recommendation is Dose Your Dreams, because it's so cool and like so far weird. Second, Cops, because classic. You have to
Cops
go for
or
it.
Police, Em, two different 7 inches. Do you mean Cops or do you mean Police?
Oops. You know what? I'm sticking with Cops, because I like Cops. I like that one. I like Police. Police is great, but we're doing the follow-up. We're doing Cops. Mm. And then, oh, what's the... One minute.
There's so much. I'm looking at their discography now.
And then I'm caught between either Hidden World or Year of the Horse. But
I like...
Yeah.
You guys gave me a lot to work with. There's all kinds of stuff. I'm gonna listen to one of each of your recommendations tomorrow, and I'll
Hell
report
yeah.
that. I like. Oh, I was just gonna yes. say really quick. I'm so sorry. I'm just looking at their discography and I got distracted. The Glass Boys record that has the slowed down versions of it is really cool. It's like the double LP that has just like half speed. of that I remember really liking that too, but those were like my only real
The effed up
notes.
discography. So deep, so deep. One trivia question before we do our final story. What iconic, foundational, extremely important rock singer musician started out as a professional mime before becoming a musician?
Oh, I wish I
I think I know.
Knew. And
Is
more?
it David Bowie?
David Bowie, a mime.
Yeah!
And
There you go. That's so cool.
on the final David Bowie music video, where he
So
literally
cool.
was dying and knew he was
Oh,
dying,
yeah.
he portrayed a mime yet again before going back into a cupboard. Pretty trippy. Last story, and then we're going to shut this one down.
That's so cool.
The best tour of the
So
winter has been
cool.
announced. The Totally Tubular Fest. Flock of Seagulls, Men Without Hats, Bow Wow Wow, and also some other bands. Flock of Seagulls. People think they're a crappy 80s band, but they're actually extremely
They're
amazingly awesome.
great.
I've seen them 5 times, and the last time I saw them was the best time so far, and I'm super psyched. The first time I saw them was at one of these 80s fests like 5 years ago, and all the other bands were like, "Wee, who remembers the 80s? 80s." Which honestly, I didn't mind because it's the 80s fest. People are there to have fun and drink. Fine. But Flock of Seagulls, they come out in all black, black sunglasses,
Fuck yeah.
and they acted like they weren't, they're like timeless, not timely. You know, they were
They're
like,
still, they are timeless, I think. Like they did space. Did they do Space Age Love Song?
oh, they did indeed.
Like they're a really good band. Like they're
Oh,
not
yeah.
just an 80s band to me. Like they did also to me feel like a more classic new wave, you know? So I love to know that they're still killing it like that, you know?
They are killing it like that. And I just saw them maybe 4 or 5 months ago, and they did a bunch of new stuff. The new stuff is almost as good as the first record. They're on fire. Go see them. But also
Fuck yeah.
playing Men Without Hats. You say, John, isn't Men Without Hats like a totally shitty 80s band? Wrong. Men Without Hats is an 80s band, probably more 80s than Flock of Seagulls. But actually, their first record, what's it called? Dance of the 80s or something? I forgot the name of it. Hey, whatever, the first record, whatever it is, super good. And there's one song called Antarctica, which literally could be a Bauhaus song. The whole record,
Okay,
super
I
good.
gotta delve into that.
Check it out.
I love Safety Dance Always, even though it's like
Yeah.
kind of become a joke, one hit wonder. When I was a kid, that was like my favorite song.
Well, it's a great album. It really is. And apparently they're amazing. Like my friend Ann, who runs the machine shop, who puts out Kepi Guli. Maura, don't you know Kepi Guli, or am I misremembering? Like, aren't you pals with him?
I wouldn't say I'm pals, but like I know, like we have a ton of mutual friends, like
Yeah.
because I'm friends with Dog Party and they toured with Kepi Guli for like years. They were his backing bands. And then like Danny Bailey, one of my besties, shout out Danny Bailey. She was friends with him, you know, in the Bay, and he, I don't know. I know Megan, who is my best friend, is buds with him because she, you know, she toured. We were in the band Boys together for a minute, but and she played in Homeless Gospel Choir, and she plays in my current bands, but she what was I gonna say? She's toured with Kepi. And because she used to tour Lipstick Homicide, and he is hilarious and he's a ray of light. I love that she apparently she got him into goats. He's really into goats now. So she told him that goats can like mow your lawn. She's like, if you get a goat, it'll mow your lawn. And now he's like obsessed with goats, which I think is hilarious to think about Kepi Guli with a yard full of goats eating and chomping. I think it's hilarious and
Kebby
I love
Cooley,
it.
a truly unique person who I'm a massive fan of and could also strangle sometimes. But great
Oh yeah, for
musician.
sure.
He is. I've interviewed him twice, and both times I'm like, I can't use this interview. It's like I'm
What did
interviewing
he
Pete.
do? That's so funny.
Like I'll be so I'll be like, so you re-recorded your album Animation Festival, no, Reanimation Festival, and you recorded exactly the same even though you own the record. Why'd you do that? And he's like, because it's fun. I like hanging out with my friends. That's what I do for fun. I love fun. And I'm like, but like every
Yeah, that's
question is
his
that
vibe.
answer. And I'm like he is like Pee Wee Herman on like pop rocks. Like he's the man. He's
Yes,
the you know.
that's
Oh,
so
but
true. That's a
also,
good in comparison.
but actually, I'm minimizing Kepi, and I take everything I said back, because when everyone else was like, oh yeah, Dixon, they're Nazis, but we're gonna look the other way. Kepi was the only dude that didn't look the other way and fought the giant and won to a degree. And
Hell yeah.
Kepi's the man. I take everything back. I curse me, well, not curse me, but I feel bad about talking smack on Kepi. Kepi's the man. Go
no,
buy
you're
his
not
music.
Talking smack. You're just doing regular shit talking. You're an East Coast person.
Go
you're allowed
buy
to do that.
Go buy his new Rolling Stones cover 12-inch single where he does Start Me Up and then a reggae version of Start Me Up, dub version. It's awesome.
Love
check
that.
It out. Anyway, the reason I got
existed.
Off of this is Annie loves Men Without Hats. Who she puts out some of McKeppy's records. She said Men Without Hats is great. The last band also playing. Bow Wow Wow. You say, John, Bow Wow Wow. Isn't that like the most 80s band? Wrong again. Bow Wow Wow, first of all, was managed by Malcolm McLaren. Not that that gives them punk vibes, because Malcolm McLaren.
No, that's
bag.
Cool.
But, so it's cool. go check out. Like, first of all, Annabella is an amazing singer, an amazing songwriter. She's amazing live. The band is super unique. Go check out their records, especially the 12-inch single. Well, actually, my favorite Bow Wow Wow song is Wild in the Country. And what's cool is the album version of Wild in the Country talks about how, you know, it's like fun to live off the land and be in nature and stuff. But then the 12-inch single version is the flip side of that. And it's how society has crumbled. There's only urban warfare, and you should have fun in a post-apocalypse warfare
sick.
Universe and just have fun. And Bow Wow Wow is amazing. And I don't mean this ironically or chicly. I mean, like, Bow Wow Wow is a frigging amazing band. And I've seen Annabella 3 times, and she's awesome. And I've interviewed her, and she's Annabella, and she's cool as hell. So
that's so sick.
And more, I think you should go to the Tony Cubo tour. It's going to be cool. So
yeah, I want to now. It's funny because I like all these bands. I'm a huge fan of like 80s new wave. Like I grew up with all that shit. My dad put me onto all that stuff, and like I love all the 80s hits. I love new wave. I love synth pop. I love Pet Shop Boys. I love all kinds of shit like that. And I'm excited to check out more Bow Wow Wow because I know like their hits, like what's their hit?
I Want Candy.
Oh yeah. But like I've never really like delved. So you know, I appreciate this.
We'll close this out with this. M Moore and Mora, pick 3 new wave records, and then we'll close it out with a song. I will pick 3 right now. Waitresses, okay. Bow Wow Wow. I think I gotta go Flock of Seagulls. I think that's what I gotta do. M Moore, what's your 3 new wave records?
Oh, my 3 new wave records. Parallel Lines, Blondie.
Ah! Excellent choice.
Yeah. Gotta go classic. New Order, but I don't know which one.
New Order's so good.
Which one, though? They are. Let's do Substance, I guess. And I need one more. What's another one? Okay,
yeah,
I
there's so many.
There's so much good stuff. I've never listened to this, but I'm picking it based on the name alone, and it's Men Without Hats, and it's Greatest Hats.
Oh,
that's because
I think
awesome.
It's really great.
It's fucking
it's just
awesome.
A hat.
Moira Weaver, what are your 3 new wave picks?
See, that's so hard because, like, what constitutes as new wave in my mind? Because I'm like, would London Calling be a new wave record? Does that count to you?
No, it's punk.
Then let's not count it. Okay, then let's not count it. But, like, okay, let's see. Okay, definitely Tears for Fears, Songs from the Big Chair. That's a big one for me because I just love Tears for Fears. Yeah, like you don't, do you consider like the Smiths or the Cure like new wave?
See, I don't, but if you did, I wouldn't argue with you on that one. I would argue on the Clash, but I would not argue on Smiths who'd you say? Smiths.
That's
and,
what I'm saying. That's what's hard. The Cure. Because if we're counting the Smiths and the Cure, then I'm definitely going to say the Queen is Dead. I'm definitely going to like in Devo. Like,
yeah,
it's just hard. It's hard. It's hard because I could go farther down and like, okay, I really, let's see. I really love Men at Work too.
Oh, I love Men at Work. I saw Men at Work. Men at Work is amazing. Have you ever seen them live?
I've never
live,
seen them live.
Which is Colin Hay and his Brazilian wife and her Brazilian cousins. So that's not really Australian, but whatever. And they were amazing.
I gotta see them. And I really love XTC. I really like them, but I'm like they're another one where they're like they're rock, but they have the new wave elements, you know? But if I were choosing XTC, I'd say, not Skylarking, but maybe the one. Why can't I think of the name of the one that has, oh, Drums and Wires. Yeah. The one that has Senses Working Overtime and it has a Making Plans for Nigel.
Where they
That's
have
my
it. Mo
shit.
Mora's new wave picks. Mora has been a total delight.
Yes.
And let's talk about her new record one more time that's coming out. And we're all psyched about it. It's called Strange Devotion. It's out September 19 via Feel It Records. The first single, Prince Is Out. There's going to be some more coming out. Mora, any last words that you want the listeners to know about before we shut this party on down?
Man, I don't know. Just yeah, listen to the new wave records we said. Keep your eyes peeled because I've got more songs coming out soon.
Well, there you have it.
And
And
I'm
let's
going
let
on tour in the fall. Yeah, that's all. You know, and
so
have a
go
good night, everyone. Have a good night.
so go see more on tour. Let's cut this on down, close this on out with the mimes, the darkness, the twisted vibes, the
The evil
strange
mimes, the
atmosphere, the evil
mimes.
mimes. Let's play. What do you think about the ugliest one? One of the trippier or more bent tracks. What do you think of
Love
that?
that song.
This is
Love
The
that
Ugliest
song.
One by the Mimes, which includes Mora and some of her current collaborators as well. And we will see you. And when are we going to see him?
Next week.
Yeah.